We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
I'm starting this one.
Yes, I'm recording.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Kim, and of course, I am joined by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
Hey, Kim. Thanks for choosing such a good episode. You chose, like, I think we've said it back and forth. Sometimes when the other person chooses the episode, I think we tend to enjoy it a little bit more because it takes the pressure off of it. Mm-hmm. I think they're all good. It's just, I think sometimes when I choose the episode, I think, maybe I chose a bit of a lame duck. But this was a great episode.
Yeah, I like the later ones. I feel like they're trying to compete more with like a 2020, a Dateline kind of story. And it's like you get four of them in one. So it's awesome.
You also get a different intro. They get a little bit of a, I guess, an X-Files-y intro to these shows. And they're trying to be a little, they've got the fog machine, like, turned up to 10. They're really trying to get it up. They're like, give him another raincoat to wear. But all in all, yeah, you chose season 11, episode 7. It aired sometime in 2001, 2002.
Yeah, these stories are all kind of picked and pulled. The Bad Dad episode, which is the third story here, actually aired September 10th of 2001. So I'm sure that one got quickly forgotten with all the hubbub of September 11th.
Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of people might not even know that for like 3 months following the 9/11 attacks, nothing was on except for the news.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't really return to regular TV until the new year. It's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Rough time. But this first one is about Jesse James Hollywood. And if this story sounds familiar to you, there is a movie in 2007 called Alpha Dog with Justin Timberlake.
Yeah. Betsy saw that movie, of course.
What?
I think, she sees every movie. Like, if it's a bad movie about true crime, she's seen it. But she did not know it was about this. So I don't know. I don't know. Because this story really affected her. I think... for a number of reasons, but she just thought that the brother is such a scumbag. And
I know.
It's just, it affected her a lot. And when I told her about that, she was very surprised. But she will not go back and watch it again.
Oh, okay. Well, this one is a messed up story and the brother is like such a disgusting person, but we basically start with seeing footage of Nick Markowitz. He is 15 years old and he is celebrating his bar mitzvah.
A little late, but at the same, like we talked a little bit about that. Normally, a boy has his bar mitzvah, a girl has his bat mitzvah at 13. Mm-hmm. But you have the ceremony at 13. Like this year, just, my son is turning 13. We're having the bar mitzvah, but we're going to have the bar mitzvah party next year. So hopefully we can, so things aren't as nutty.
Yeah, totally.
It's not totally uncommon, but it's not totally normal either.
It's a little unusual. This is actually the last footage that we ever have of Nick. So,
which is weird,
Yeah. Well, Nick has this scumbag 25-year-old half-brother named Ben who has just always been a ne'er-do-well, kind of a loser, druggy kind of guy.
Yeah.
Ben owes money to a young man whose real name is Jesse James Hollywood.
Yeah, it's little baby Jesse James.
Yeah, exactly. And somebody on YouTube said, how do you name your kid Jesse James Hollywood and not expect him to become a suburban meth dealer?
There's not too many paths you're going to take down. You know it's not going to be Jesse James Hollywood POTUS, I guess he could have changed it to, Johnny Hollywood. But it's a really kind of sleazy kind of name. It's crazy.
Yeah, and he comes from kind of sleazy stock, as we'll get into in a little bit. But on August 6th of 2000, Jesse James Hollywood needs to collect a debt from scumbag brother Ben. So Hollywood and two other hoodlums hop into this like windowless van and they are cruising the streets. They are going to like shake Ben down for the money that that he owes them.
Robert Stack talks about them like they're just regular suburban middle class kids.
Yeah, no.
In a windowless van? I don't know. I just felt like that setup was a little bit poorly timed.
In a windowless van, and they're talking about, oh, but he used to be, like, really good at baseball as a kid. It's like, well, now he owns this, like, crazy drug den.
Right, that was 9 years ago, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't we all, you know? So this whole video, I point out to you, is straight up, like, Malibu's Most Wanted. It's like these guys trying to act so, like, thug-a-lugging and tough, but they're in, like, West Hills, California. So at the age of 19, he owned enough money to have that like whole drug house. And it was just like a party all the time. 2 miles away from his little drug den is where 15-year-old Nick lives with his mom and dad, Jeff and Susan. So Ben is like kind of a drug buddy of Hollywood, the brother. He owes $1,200 to Hollywood over drugs.
Now, do you think that this is one of those situations where it's like, look, I'm going to give you this weed and you're going to sell it.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is how you make money. Because I think that's kind of how it works.
That was like the first thing in my mind is that Hollywood is probably like a middle range drug dealer.
And he's super low level. Yeah.
Yeah. Is super low level. Now, because nobody is going to let you just keep borrowing $1,200 and keep fronting you whatever drugs.
And $1,200 comes up again in the story. So
yeah, it does. But also, like, on the mom, on Nick's mom's tribute to her son, she said that it was only $200. But in all the L.A. County stuff I've read, they said it was $36,000. So I'm like, whoa, these numbers are so far apart.
Yeah, that's... It was money, and people were...
Yeah.
I mean, $36,000, I can understand being more upset about than $1,200, especially $200. But...
Yeah.
Very, very strange. I think we both agree $1,200 is kind of like the startup funds for your little side business to sell weed.
Yeah, and apparently this particular $1,200 is because the two bought all these like fake ecstasy pills and they were supposed to sell them. And apparently Ben only sold a certain amount, but I'm guessing he kind of pocketed the rest of them.
What are fake ecstasy pills, do you think? I mean, is this kind of like
Altoids?
But do you think it's like they got some like Valium and mixed it in with a few Quaaludes or something and made something super weak?
No, I'm guessing it's like sugar pills.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, seventh graders, you want to try this hard stuff? And they're like, oh my God, my mom would be so mad. Hold my retainer. Like, I don't know. That's
$2,000 worth of them, though.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like $2,000 worth of sugar pills. That does seem like a lot. So I don't know what it was.
And he was only able to sell $600 worth. The $600 total, $600 spent from buying fake drugs. I mean, that's so many disappointed people.
Yeah, exactly. And talk about disappointed people. Apparently, he went to his dad and was like, Dad, I tried to buy some fake ecstasy, and I kind of owe Hollywood, like, $1,400, so can you front me some money? And the dad's like, here's $200, my apple of my eye. Here you go.
Here's another thing. This is the height of the rave time, right? This is, like, rave city nation. And, I mean, at least in, you know... on the East Coast and probably West Coast. I mean, maybe he could just kind of go to a rave and start selling ecstasy like crazy. Ecstasy is a pretty relatively cheap drug, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, he apparently grew Markowitz, okay? We're talking about Ben. Ben was like, man, screw this guy who's like hounding me for all this money I owe him, $1,200. You know what? Screw you. F off, like they said, an expletive-laden rant. And so this leads to quite the souring of the relationship between Hollywood and scumbag brother Ben. So Unsolved Mysteries talks to Ben from prison. Mm-hmm. Ben is in, like, his, like, jumpsuit orange, and he's laughing, and he's like, oh, man, like, that guy was so shrimpy. I'm not afraid of him. I'm not no punk. And, like, oh, my God, he had no remorse.
Right. It's like he just didn't learn a lesson. He's not a smart person.
No, he's the worst.
He thinks it's actually, I mean, I definitely think he's the type of person who's like, now I have prison on my resume and I'll be tough. It proves that I'm street now.
Yeah, and he was in prison for armed robbery charges, and this was far from the first or the last time that our beloved little Ben goes to prison. So, apparently Hollywood confronts Ben on many occasions. Apparently, they went to Ben's fiance's place of business, and when she left him the bill, they just wrote Ben's dead on a napkin and just, like, left. And then Ben also said that he started leaving Hollywood threatening messages where he's like, I know where you live. I know where your family lives. So if you want to play games with, like, my girl, then I'll, like, play games right back with you. With
and
your
it's all
family.
Weak. It's all, like, kind of, it's all, you know, I'm going to punch you harder than you're going to punch me.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess Hollywood took it a little bit further.
Yeah.
That's the thing, because it steps into the world of kidnapping.
Yeah, I don't know if we even mentioned this, sorry, no, but when they're in the windowless van and they're looking for Ben, they find sweet little innocent 15-year-old Nick just, like, skipping stones or whatever, and they just start roughing
him
up.
Yeah, he's just walking
in the van.
Yeah, they're like, do you know where your brother is? No, yeah, you do. You're coming with us. And then,
exactly.
And he's tied up and he's a hostage.
Yep, exactly. So the next day, witnesses report seeing Nick at the house, but they're like, he's not even bound or gagged. Like, in the Unsolved Mysteries, they were having, like, a pool party with this guy. And apparently that's all Alpha Dog is about, is where they're like, I saw the preview for it, and she's like, you're a hostage? That's hot. And, like, they totally were having just, like, a drinking, banging, like, all kind of crazy party. And Nick was just kind of there for the ride.
And
you know, he's 15.
And I think that for the most part, that was the intention. I don't think that the intention was to get dark here.
Yeah, so, like, he never tried to exchange him for ransom, but something, for whatever reason, starts kind of weighing at Hollywood's conscience. So he calls his lawyer, and he's like, oh, hey, you know, long time no talk. Funny story, I totally kidnapped this kid. Like, what am I looking at here? And he was like, if you demand a ransom, then you're getting life in prison. There's no two ways about this. So he's like, huh, okay, well, you know, that was a hypothetical. So he hangs
right,
up.
Right.
And he's like, there's only one thing to do. I got to kill this 15-year-old who didn't do anything.
I mean, so, it's just, it seems as though there's a good relationship right now with Nick.
Yeah.
The younger brother, Nick. And I'm just kind of curious if Hollywood was like, look, I'm going to give you $100. Shut up. You know,
yeah.
I just don't know if we could have gone that route a little bit, or if this kid is like, I want to leave. I want to leave, because he's probably just a normal kid, you know, who, you know what, all this might be great in 3 years, but today it's scaring the crap out of him.
For sure. Oh my God. I can't imagine that. I mean, that would be super scary. From what I understand, his parents started seeing him kind of go down the scumbag brother Ben path. They were afraid that he might be getting started in drugs and stuff. So we're saying sweet little innocent Nick, not necessarily super innocent, but in this case, he is innocent.
Now, can I ask you, how long was he held? Do we know?
He was held for like 2 days.
And the parents, I mean, the parents had no input
on
this?
The mom said she's like paging him because he left. She was cooking him breakfast and he just peaced out. Like, who knows? Maybe he was sleeping over at somebody else's house. I don't know. But she's paging him and he will not respond to her. So I'm sure they're freaking out. Hollywood decides to call his fellow thug, 21-year-old Ryan Hoyt. Ryan Hoyt also owes him $1,200 for drugs.
Yeah, this is all crazy. It does come to such a quick ending, but the stupidity involved here could have been just so avoided.
I'm guessing this is mostly a drug-addled mind kind of thing, because this is how it makes sense to people. So from my understanding, Hoyt is who Justin Timberlake plays in that Alpha Dog movie. And Hollywood calls Hoyt and he's like, hey, I got a way for you to work off your drug debt.
$1,200.
So, yeah, well, who isn't willing to kill a 15-year-old for $1,200? Like,
how much money is owed to Hollywood in the world, you know?
Oh, my God. Honestly, we know of at least two guys, and there's that video camera of them in this, like, super drug house. There's, like, no furniture, nothing on the walls or anything.
I've been to that house. Like, I'm sure you've been to that house party before.
Oh, God.
I've definitely run into people who have acted like this or who seem to have money all the time, but they own nothing of any nice, of any quality. Mm-hmm. It's just a very strange existence. And yeah, I mean, I'm not comfortable around those kind of people. I haven't seen those kind of people in decades, but it's just, it really brought back the whole like 90s thug life.
Yes.
Fakeness, I guess.
Ugh, yeah. Yeah. So, I got such bad like memories.
Well, you were back, like so, yeah. 8.
No, I know, not in the 90s, but I'm talking about like druggy teenage experiences. Mm-hmm. And you go to people's houses and you're like, why am I here? Am I going to make it out alive? They have a baby that's around all this. Like, ugh, you just go into people's environment that you don't want
to
be
It starts
in.
Like really, you see how easy it could be to go down this path of just degradation. You know, just your whole life is spiraling out of control, but you're laughing about it the whole time. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, so... Here we go, August 8th, 2000. So Ryan Hoyt, who we talked about, and two other ruffians take Nick to the Lizard's Mouth Trail in Ponte Vedra National Forest. And there was already a grave that was pre-dug awaiting them there. So they take Nick out there, they shoot him 9 times, and they kill him and bury him out there. And apparently this was with like a T9 tech gun, and Hollywood gave Hoyt the gun. So on August 12th, only 4 days later, Nick's body is discovered by hikers because this was A, shallow grave, and B, a super popular hiking trail.
It's just, there's so much stupidity about that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to dig a grave, and I'm not saying, I think this is a terrible way to for this child to be murdered, or there's no good way, but you dig a little deeper? I don't know. Like, how shallow is a shallow grave, you think? 2 feet?
Oh my God. 2 feet
below his body. I don't know either.
I don't know. Like, oh, it's so sad. And, you know, all these people that we're talking about, these big criminal drug lords, they're all like 20. They're all 17 to 20 years old. It's crazy. So we're not talking about the smartest people in general. But they are able to talk to a teenage informant who tells them about the parties that Hollywood was having with Nick there. So Ryan Hoyt and, quote, 3 other accomplices who Unsolved Mysteries does not name, but I am going to name, are arrested. So the shooter is 20-year-old Ryan Hoyt. The van driver slash duct taper is Jesse Ruge. He's 20. The grave digger is 17-year-old Graham Presley. And kidnapper slash rougher-upper guy who kidnapped him is William Skidmore. He is also 20. They all plead not guilty, and at the time of broadcast, those charges are pending. We have updates on that, but the main Unsolved Mysteries aspect of it is that Hollywood is nowhere to be found. He's fled.
And that's another thing. I'm wondering, you have these 4 people. Did they all owe money to Hollywood?
I don't know. I'm guessing so. I mean, when the big boss guy tells you to do something, you kind of do it. And then you get the mob mentality aspect in there.
There's a whole organized crime thing here. I think in some ways, maybe I'm even kind of thinking of Hollywood as even more low level than initially. Because, I mean, he has people working for him.
Yeah.
At least 4.
Yeah, exactly. And with Graham Presley, I mean, he's 17. This big, scary guy with all these guns and all these drugs who's willing to kill teenagers tells you to go dig a grave, you're going to go dig a grave.
That you know? Potentially owe money to, you know.
Yeah, totally. It's scary stuff.
That is.
We do get an update. On March 8th of 2005, Hollywood was found hiding out in Brazil. He was arrested, sent back to California, and is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole at Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility in San Diego. Now, he actually got this woman pregnant in Brazil on purpose because for some reason he misunderstood that if you have a baby in Brazil, they won't extradite you. And they were like, no, you're definitely going. So he never even met this baby. And he has this like social media account from prison that is obviously run by like his dad or his mom or something. And they really play up like, isn't it sad this baby's never met his father? It's like he did on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing is kind of crazy. I just hope you got to see the Rio parades that they have there. Kind of amazing.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, you lived there for how many years? But...
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to go to Brazil. You know, it just seems like such a big leap. But to do that, I don't know. It just really kind of also shows you deeper what kind of person this is. He's going to have a child just to stay there.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know... Talking about father-son bonds, on the same day that Jesse James Hollywood is arrested in Brazil, his father, Jack, is arrested for manufacturing GHB, a.k.a. the date rape drug.
Yeah.
And he was those charges were later thrown out in court, but he remained in custody on an outstanding 2002 warrant for a marijuana-related charge and later got 18 months in an Arizona prison for it.
Now, it seems to me that, you know, GHB, we hear all the time about, you know, the date rape drug, and it's so dangerous, yeah. And it seems to be everywhere. It's the kind of thing that somebody drops into somebody's drink when they're not looking. But the only common medical use I found that GHB is used for is narcolepsy and sometimes alcoholism. But I'm just kind of – that's the best treatment you can have for narcolepsy. I mean –
yeah.
Like maybe, I don't know, make it illegal. It just seems like it's so rampantly used for something else, for date rape. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just doesn't, it seems like maybe it's too dangerous to be manufacturing.
Oh, because narcolepsy, I totally agree.
I don't know. You can figure out something else, I'm assuming, right? Narcolepsy is where you just fall asleep sometimes. I mean, often.
I would assume GHB would be horrible for that unless you're trying to, like, channel your sleepiness into one time a day so you're not sleeping the rest of it. I really don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either. It just seems like another one of these situations where maybe smoking weed might help with narcolepsy if you're just trying to get some sleep or something like that. But I'm not a doctor. Don't take my advice. But it just seems weird to me that GHB is being manufactured even today legally. And prescribed legally for narcoleptics and sometimes alcoholism.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Well, we told you we have updates on those sentences. So Ryan Hoyt, the main guy who shot him, actually was sentenced to death. Jesse is serving life without the possibility of the parole. He's one of the kidnappers. Graham Presley, the 17-year-old, he was actually sentenced as a youth, and he was released in 2007. And William Skidmore, one of the kidnappers, he got a plea deal, and he served 9 years. He was released in 2009. So,
You said sentenced to death, right? And but he's not. He wasn't put to death because there's no death penalty in California anymore.
Well, there is, but he's not doing it. Kind of thing. Gavin Newsom isn't doing it, but you know, even. Even normally, I mean, isn't it like a 30-year ordeal? Like,
you know, I don't know. I was going to ask you, what's the difference between sentenced to death and life in prison if there's no death? Like, if the prison's not literally giving you the needle or, you know, the electric chair or whatever. I don't know. You hear sentenced to death, I think, okay, when?
Well, and, I'm assuming that it's a thing that's like you have a standing death penalty. So when the next guy gets elected and is like, I'm going to execute all these people, he can still.
That seems dark, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I know. But, you know, I really don't know the difference. Okay. I know Newsom's a pretty liberal guy. But in 2003, the Markowitz family won a lawsuit against the kidnappers and the murderers. They got $11.2 million. Nick's mom wrote a book about it called My Stolen Son.
Mm. Yeah, and the cover of it is a little bit sad. You know, it's just him and it's the bar mitzvah boy and his mom. And, you know, it's a sad situation because the kid looks so normal, you know.
I know.
But, yeah, it's you could find they do have ongoing stuff going on Facebook. It seems that people do constantly talk to them. People have an interest. You have these creepy women who are reaching out to Hollywood and saying, you're innocent, I'm waiting for you.
Oh, Hollywood's married.
But the women are still, like, you know, hitting on him because he seems to be in love with himself, actually.
I'm just saying, like, he got married in prison.
Crazy.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, now we're going to move to a very specific fear that I have. This is Writer Down, which we got a lot of this info from Unsolved Wiki and Indie Star, which is, like, an Indianapolis, Indiana newspaper. So, in May 31st of 2000, and you guys hold on for this one because it's got a crazy current update. We're in Bloomington, Indiana, and a little after 9:32 a.m., 19-year-old Jill Berman decides to go for a bike ride. Her job starts at noon, and she has plans to meet after for her with her dad and her grandparents for a late lunch.
Yeah, she's – well, I mean, she, like, loves biking. It's, like, her favorite sport. Mm-hmm. And – she's one of these kind of really kind of organized people, it seemed. Like, she's going to go on this bike ride. She's going to be to work at a certain time. She's, like, plans for the whole day. It's not like she's just going to kind of disappear. And when she does, it becomes a very strange thing. because
and she had just completed her freshman year too at Indiana State University. She is misreliable.
Yeah. And that night, she doesn't come home, and parents, of course, are freaking out. There's no trace of her. But on June 2nd, which is three days later. How many days?
Three days.
Yeah, later. 3 days later, the quote of hundreds of townspeople conduct a search for her. So I'm wondering, was she well known? Because that's the only way I would probably, you know, if I knew, like, hey, that guy down the street went missing, and like, oh, well, he's a nice guy, I'll do what I can.
You know, she seems like a very good girl from very good stock. Like, I'm assuming that's why a lot of people went out to search for her. And it's scary. I mean, when you hear 19-year-old women are possibly being snatched off the street, you kind of want to, like, put that person away.
I think of Parks and Rec with this whole story because of Indiana. And I don't know. I do picture that small town community maybe coming together and doing that. So
yeah, but this is Bloomington. This is a big city.
Oh, it is. All right. I don't know anything about outside of New York. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, no worries. But, so basically, everyone's searching for her. No one can find any trace of her. The same day, a man independently comes forward and is like, I found this bicycle a few days ago. I was planning on keeping it, but it turns out it belongs to a missing woman, which you have to be like crap in your pants if you by it, honestly.
It's like a $3,000 bike, probably, you know, because she's probably definitely, you know, it's her hobby, you know, it's like this is something that she probably took a lot of pride in. And it's like you just kind of come across it, quote unquote.
I know. And like, you know, they're looking at you. Oh, my God, that must have been so scary. But
and your fingerprints are all over it. But, you know, that's another thing. You pick that thing up all of a sudden. Wow. Just talk about having a bad day. You know, it's kind of like it's why you have to be careful about what you're just kind of picking up on the side of the street.
So true. And I'm sure once he realized it belonged to her, oh, my God. But the serial number on the bike is the same as her serial number. But the weird thing is she was last seen by motorists riding south, but her bike was found 10 miles north of where she was last seen. So the next day, a woman's walking along this church parking lot, and she finds Jill's little portable radio in the day before iPods. And it's the same model and the same color that Jill took with her on her bike ride. So as soon as it's found and picked up, they show this like suspicious vehicle just like peeling out, and they're like, we should take a closer look at that guy.
Yeah, but they never found out who that was, right?
Not that we know of. I mean, I feel like they are kind of holding their cards close to the chest with this one, because at the time of Unsolved Mysteries, it's so unsolved, they don't want to give away too much info. So 10 days later, about 3 miles from where Jill's bike was found in this small little town called Ellettsville, some man attempted to abduct a young woman, and Unsolved Mysteries is like, are these related? We don't know. So they show us a sketch, and the guy has very similar eyes to the guy who ends up getting arrested. I wonder if it was the same guy. A year later in Kentucky, this is where, like, one of my biggest fears is and has been for, like, 10 years. This young woman is riding her bike, and a motorist purposely crashes into her for the purpose of abducting her.
I mean, it's a good tactic. It's just horrifying.
Isn't that messed up? It's so unfair. Like, you don't stand a chance. And I used to ride my bike home from work at 10 o'clock at night from the restaurant that I used to work at. And I would pedal so fast because I once saw an episode of the show Disappeared where this happens. The guy hits her. She's like, whoa, what happened? And her ride's obviously messed up. And then he takes her, chucks her in the back of the truck, rapes her, murders her.
Yeah, and like, what are you supposed to do? It's like you're bleeding probably, you know? And how long of a ride was that in Oregon?
It was only like a mile and a half. It really wasn't far, but it got me there very fast because I would pedal so fast. I'd be so scared.
It's like you went from a 10-minute casual ride to like 3 minutes.
Yeah, I would come back home. I'd be like huffing and puffing, but you know, it was also
like you like skid out when you get home.
Totally, yeah. But we learned that the bike didn't actually have too much damage to it. So they're thinking that maybe these cases aren't connected. And that woman, by the way, it was thwarted by a good Samaritan. So thankfully she did not get abducted, the woman in Kentucky. But we do get an update because in March of 2003, sadly, Jill's skeletal remains were found in a remote area outside of Bloomington by two hunters.
Now, we don't learn much about how she was killed on Unsolved Mysteries, but you uncovered some information that kind of, you know, it really surprised me because I thought that this was a regular I don't know what this was, to be honest with you. Maybe just an abduction and that was it. But this turns into a much darker tale.
Yeah, this one gets real crazy. And so she had a shotgun wound to the back of her head. And 3 years later, on March 9th of 2006, police arrest longtime suspect John R. Myers Jr. He was arrested and found guilty of her murder. He was a suspect for a long time for a couple of reasons. One, her bike was found a mile from where he lived. He was on vacation from work when she vanished, and he was supposedly, like, hysterical after and was like, I have to leave town. I'm going to leave town. I'm never going to come back. The windows in his trailer and his car were all, like, covered up the day that she disappeared. He owned the same kind of shotgun. He told his aunt that he was afraid police were going to pin Jill's disappearance on him shortly after Jill disappeared. And apparently he would just talk about Jill's case to anybody who would listen.
Now, being obsessed with the case and telling his aunt about that he's afraid that it was going to get back to him somehow, even though he, on paper, has no connection whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Everything else, I think, can be explained. I don't see there being concrete evidence. So that's why I'm kind of, or am I wrong? Also,
well,
I did want to mention, he had the same kind of shotgun. So shotguns, I don't believe, can be like a regular revolver. They can't be tested to see if it came from there because it's like a bird shot or it's some type of it. There's no trace. Is that? Do you know that? Or
I don't know that.
Yeah, I don't know that either. I never really thought about that, and it's something I'm going to look up, but. But you of course have heard of, you know, if they can determine if a gun had fired a certain bullet.
Oh yeah, that's like ballistics.
But I don't think it happens with shotguns, apparently.
Well, I'm not sure, but I knew that this guy was sentenced to 65 years in prison. At first, I'm like, burn him, he's so guilty, I hate this guy. But then I got to thinking of the mindset, and I just ask you to try this mindset on that he is a simple mofo, and he got railroaded people that were looking for answers. So we say that because in October of 2019, a federal court vacated his sentence for ineffective assistance of counsel. And apparently his counsel was super ineffective. He didn't request that the jury was sequestered. He didn't object when the prosecution said that Jill was raped because apparently there was no trace of her being raped. Well, you know, skeletal remains. Mm-hmm. And like he was just kind of asleep at the switch here. So it sounds like he does deserve a new trial. So he was ordered to be released or retried within 120 days from October of 2019. So the attorney general is like, oh, we are going to retry this case. But he was ordered to be released on June 15th of 2020, which at the time that we're recording this is like 3 months ago.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, he's still in prison. So I'm not sure what's going on. I'm not sure if maybe the attorney general is allowed to file appeals or say we need more time for this case. But he's kind of in limbo in jail from what I can tell.
Now, if there's not any other evidence, which there easily could be, that we have no idea about, I get a kind of Johnny Lee Wilson feel about this. Like you said, he could just be a simple thing. And
yeah,
I don't know.
Or he could have done it. I don't know. But
we just can't put somebody in prison without real concrete evidence. That's all.
Yeah.
I can't anyway, Your Honor. Yeah. but let's head over to Long Island. Because on Long Island, things are a little bit crazy around here. And
this one bummed me out.
In 1986, I was newly teenager, and living life.
Living your best Fonzie life.
I was on my BMX bike riding ramps at this point. Mm. So we are introduced to Billy Fisher and Nancy Heyer. He's 19, she's 21, which is kind of an interesting thing to have a 21-year-old hanging out with a 19-year-old. But Billy has cystic fibrosis. And I wonder if this was Nancy's being a good girl. I'm going to be friends with this kid who's clearly pretty sick.
Well, so they met because she was on a train. They were on the train together. And she was head of her New York City. She's from Hicksville, New York. And she was lost. Mm. So he was like, hey, I'll help you. And then they were just kind of friends. They were friends for 3 weeks before all of this happened. So I think that they kind of made it seem like she is just returning the favor. He helped her out when she really needed it. But they say that he was kind of wanting a little romance and she had him like severely friend zoned. She was not into it, which I mean, he was cute. I thought he was cute.
Yeah, but he had that cystic fibrosis look where he kind of was ill. I mean, these, you know, they live a tough, tough life. Constantly coughing and hacking up, literally hacking up a lung. It's just absolutely terrible, especially in 1986 when, you know, but, you know, we'll talk about that. But, so she goes out in a storm because he calls her. Am I jumping ahead too much there?
No, well, I just want to say, so they know each other for 3 weeks. She gets a call from him. She's like, hey, Billy, what's going on? He's like, my dad's being a total jag. Like, I need you to come pick me up from my dad's house. So she heads out in the storm to go pick Billy up.
Yeah. And we get the reenactments are perfect. You know, Nancy looks perfect, 1986. Long Island, the sister as well. And we get to meet.
Like chemistry between the two reenactors. Too.
Yeah, I'd say so. the reenactor I thought was kind of cool, like the Billy. Was it Billy? Yeah, Billy.
Yep.
And we meet Nancy's mom. Mom is your typical Long Island mom.
This is 100% how I picture your mom.
I'm going to send you a picture of my mom. My mom is like Skeletor. Skeletor. Okay. Yeah, like, but I know what you mean. Like, she has that Long Island aspect.
And she's just going. You're a mother. When you're a mother, you worry. Like, that's how I picture your mom.
Give me the sweet and low, you know. So, she lives in Hicksville, which is kind of an upper middle class neighborhood. Billy lives in Central Islip, a little bit of a tougher area. They're about 20 miles apart. Very different people live in these areas, just so you know.
Yeah, and Willie's dad lives in Southampton, which looked to be pretty.
Yeah, it's, you know what it is? It's not like the $50 million house. It's the $3 million house.
Oh, still not bad.
That's what I mean. It's totally upper crust. It's just one of those kind of, you know, it's like Howard Stern doesn't live there. He lives, you know, in the more expensive area, I think. So it's a rainy night. There's a storm. The mom is, you know, she's doing the whole, like, Long Island psychic thing where it says, I know something bad is going to happen. And something bad happens. She just senses, maybe mothers do have this kind of sixth sense, and she doesn't call the whole night. She just, it's not like her to call. She's like, well, she's a smart girl. Maybe she's just going to stay over there.
Yeah, because it was like a really bad storm.
Yeah, and but it's an hour and a half drive, too, so it's pretty far.
And we're going to William, like Billy's dad's house, because of the cystic fibrosis, like Billy is in a bad way. And he, because it's America, has like all these mounting crazy medical bills. And I guess his dad left the family when Billy was like 4. And his mom was like, well, I don't know what to do with these two boys. So off to foster care.
Crazy.
So I know. And he never really had anyone in his life. So he kind of talks to his dad and is like, Dad, could you like help me foot the bills?
In this big expensive house and like you sell cars and you're like, you're rich from it and you're doing all this coke.
So much coke. Oh my God. They said it was like starting to affect his work performance, but he sold these like high end cars and apparently did a ton of coke. And so Billy's like, can you just help me out? Can you help me pay a little bit of these medical bills? Like, I heard online, so take this with a grain of salt, but I saw somewhere online that Billy was actually suing his dad and that his dad invited him out and was like, let's talk about this over dinner. This way we don't have to get the courts involved. Let's try and settle this.
It's a car salesman tactic.
Exactly. Yeah. Once you get in front of me, how could you say no to this face?
Oh,
so
man.
Billy calls our girl Nancy and is like, things are getting really tense. I need you to come help me out. So that's when Nancy goes out in the storm and that's the last time her family sees her. So
this is a bit much, don't you think? I mean, all right. I'm not going to say I don't love my friends, you know, but I've known you for 3 weeks. I'm not going to drive an hour and a half to meet you at your dad's house in the middle of nowhere that I've never met. And I barely know you.
But like, honestly, and I know that I'm like doing the post-death idolization that I chastise people for. But oh my God, she looked like the sweetest girl. She had the warmest eyes. I think she was just a good person.
Yeah. she totally had that kind of like, I'm sweet and bubbly and I trust absolutely everybody. And the reenactor, yeah, I think, nailed it. She with her leopard skin type of print shirt, yeah, blouse.
She was awesome. But, like, the mom tries to go to the police and is like, I can't find my daughter. And they're like, we can't declare her missing yet because she's 21 years old. So her mom and her sister just start rummaging through all her paperwork, trying to find the directions that she wrote out to Billy's house. Why she didn't take these directions with her, I have no idea. But they do find the directions and they find that she's going to William Fisher, the dad's house.
I bet you she left them the directions the same way I send when I go to on a Craigslist thing. I send it to my wife. You never know. I'm a good guy.
But they find the number, and so they call, and they're like, have you seen Nancy? Where's Nancy? And the guy's like, oh, yeah, we had, like, a roast. She came over. What a sweetheart. Like, I gave her some wine. I got her all liquored up and then sent her on the road with my son.
That was the impression I started feeling. I was like, he's like, well, I gave them drinks. And I'm just thinking, that's not something you tell a Long Island mother.
Setting the stage a little bit, maybe, for why they're missing, you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he was doing. Like, I don't know what these crazy kids are doing. Was there tiger dill sauce with the roast, is what I'm asking.
Oh, my God. Instead of a salt shaker, it was just a shaker full of Coke. So I don't know what she put on that roast. And I'm sorry, I tease because the dad is so ridiculous. I love Nancy. I'm telling you guys, the story really bummed me out.
The reenactor is exactly what you would expect him to look like.
Oh, he's got the gold chain and the gold watch, and he's just so sleazy. I feel like he had a members-only jacket, but...
Oh, yeah, totally.
So he says they, like, left from my house, and they turned left. But it turns out if you go left from his house, you're, like, going into a lake. So she keeps calling, and she's like... has Nancy showed up? Have you heard anything from Nancy? And he's like, look, lady, I told you what I told you. Leave me alone. And he's just getting like more and more hostile with her. So finally, she can file a missing persons report with the police. Like 48 hours have passed. And on 10 days away on December 21st, 4 days before Christmas, 1986, 2 miles from the dad's house, police find Nancy's car abandoned in an Elks Lodge parking lot. And they find the, like, VIN and license plate, and they're like, oh, this goes back to that missing girl, Nancy. Let's pop the trunk.
Do we think the Elks were involved? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know.
They're a good group.
I'm not saying anything to scare me. But in the trunk, they find the bodies of 19-year-old Billy, who was shot 18 times in the head.
Not 4 times. 18.
18. Because this dad hated him that much. I mean, my God, talk about overkill.
Now, do we... We don't know. I don't know if we learn whether it was the same gun each time, which was a .22, right?
I don't know about that.
Well, no. When they pull the... little bit of a spoiler alert. When they find evidence in the house, they pull a .22 slug out.
Oh, good guy.
Now, the thing is that probably a rifle, right? We also... I don't know if we ever recover a weapon.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But I'm just wondering, with a .22, I just don't know what is shooting that many .22. Do you reload each time? I mean, 18 times, that's a lot of shooting.
You'd have to reload, I would imagine. And then, sadly, Nancy was found nude in the back of the trunk as well. She had been stabbed twice.
Now, the nude thing just does not sit well with me because there's no evidence found of rape.
Well, let me throw something out at you, okay? I just thought of this. Do you think the dad's trying to say, oh, my son murdered his little gal pal, tried to rape her, and then I murdered him because he was a bad guy? I don't know.
You know, with enough coke, that might make sense. And I'm not making a joke with it. Like you're saying, it's people doing, you know, mountains of coke and everything have done crazier things. It's just... Maybe he was creating a scenario, and then he came down, and he's like, that's not going to work, you know?
Oof, yeah, I don't know, but it's just sad. And it's interesting to have two different weapons. So you and I both kind of independently came up with the thought that Billy was probably dead before Nancy even got there. Yeah. And that he killed Nancy a completely different way, stabbed twice versus shot 18 times.
And no police, I mean, no neighbors heard this gunfire. No. You know, if you turn your stereo too loud, people complain. This is at night, there's a storm brewing, and there's gunfire. I don't know. Hearing 3 loud bangs, right, is questionable. 18? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But these neighbors are super involved, like annoying HOA neighbors, because they notice at like 3 a.m. every morning, William's been like repainting his house, cleaning the walls, vacuuming, like doing some suspicious activities. So police serve a search warrant, and in the wall, that's where they found the two 22 caliber bullets, and one of the bullets had a hair fused to it, and the hair did belong to that of 19-year-old Billy Fisher.
This was a Law and Order moment, I thought. I'm like, it was perfect, you know? Mm-hmm. Evidence, yeah. You know, evidence on so many levels, really. You have the bullet and the hair.
And they find a ton of blood when they do, like, the luminol testing where it glows.
Yeah.
And so police start trying to get a murder warrant against William Fisher. He was indicted on two counts of second-degree murder on February 25th of 1987. But 2 days later, his car is found abandoned at the JFK airport. They found that he took a mortgage of over $100,000 out on his home. And we leave Unsolved Mysteries with some age-progressed photos of him, and that's it.
You know, in 1987, you could just get on an airplane, really. Mm-hmm. There was not really too much cross-referencing. There was no TSA back then. There was no real fast computers. You know, you couldn't do much. And he could still legitimately be alive right now at 76.
He could. I mean, evil bastards always seem to live really long, honestly. Yeah. But he was like a super alcoholic, a super coke abuser. They said he just constantly was chain smoking Marlboro Reds.
Evil never dies.
Yeah.
it's just a terrible thing. You would think if he had died, though, it would have come out. But I guess if he, maybe he's over in Brazil for all we know.
Who knows? Yeah, at the time of this episode that we're recording now will be released, he would be 76 years old if he's still alive. He's 5'11". He has the tattoo of the name Mary on his right arm. Yeah. Sadly, Mama Joan died at the age of 72 in 2014.
She seems sweet. And
oh, I know.
Yeah. And according to the sister, Deborah, don't call me Debbie. So she still lives in Hicksville, you know, they didn't just uproot and leave.
I know. It's really sad. On the find a grave for Nancy, she put out there, like, can somebody please share a story of Nancy, because she needs to be remembered for more than just how she died.
Yeah, that's sad. And she did.
Yeah.
I mean, from what we've seen and learned, she did seem to be a pretty sweet girl. And
I know.
Got to learn a lesson from other people's mistakes, I guess. Don't be nice.
I guess so. My God.
So we head on to the other side of the country, San Francisco, the hugest city in the world. now, you referred to this girl, Kristen Mataferi, I think. Mm-hmm. Mataferi, did I do well with her?
Mataferi, yes.
As newly minted. And I think you hit the nail on the head with that, because she's, you know, if you've ever seen the TV show Perfect Strangers with Balky, she was like Balky. She was just there, like, staring up at the skyscrapers. And she is so happy. She's enrolled in summer classes for Berkeley, and she's from North Carolina.
Yeah, she did her, like, first year in college in North Carolina. I was getting, like, Mary Tyler Moore.
She was also very cute. She has dimples. It's
so cute. And the brownest, warmest eyes. Again, warm eyes, good girl.
Similar look. Similar look to Nancy, I think.
Yeah, but she's working her way. She's paying this off. She is, like, going to be out on her own for the first time. And she's freshly 18. She turned 18, like, 3 or 4 weeks before this happened.
I mean, that's another thing I just have to say. Now, the parents seem pretty level-headed. Mm-hmm. But you're letting your child move out after they became 18 a few hours ago.
It's not their choice.
Yeah, I know. And it is Berkeley, so. So it's school. So, you know, you are moving away legitimately for summer school, but all right.
She's like working. She's paying for it. She's working at this little coffee shop, this was Spinelli's coffee shop in Crocker Galleria Mall in San Francisco. And every time that she's off, she's going to museums. She is taking in the sights of the city. She is clicking up her heels. Like, she
that is a Mary Tyler Moore, right? When you describe it like that, it does remind me of the intro to Mary Tyler Moore. But
totally. And she's just like living her best life. So at 7 o'clock on June 23rd of 97, she shows up for work, and she works at her little coffee shop because it's the 90s. Mm-hmm. And her friend and coworker tells us on Unsolved Mysteries, like, she wanted to explore the city, but she was naive, like, of the ways of the big city. She could not handle it. Yeah, she leaves at 3 p.m. and she disappears. And she was only in San Francisco for 3 weeks at this time.
I mean, totally, she's been 18 now for 6 weeks. So, I mean, it's... Yeah. She's a child. I mean, that's the whole thing. Yeah. And you know what? Cities can be very exciting when you're that age.
Oh, my God. That's what... I mean, I moved to a smaller city, but I was like... The second I was 18, I was like, see ya. I was out on my own. I was in my own apartment by myself. Like, mm-hmm. I was just... You couldn't hold me down. And then I moved to a different state, and like, I was just like...
Yeah, you were definitely wild. You know, you were definitely more wild than... a lot of people. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's one of those things where, you know, I'm just kind of thinking from being a father, I'm just kind of like, it must be petrifying. But at the same time, you have to let go at some point.
Well, like talking about her parents, on June 27th, her parents actually, Bob and Debbie, they hop a plane to San Francisco. Apparently, her dad was like calling and calling and calling her apartment. And one of her roommates answers the phone and is like, oh, yeah, Kristen, yeah, she's been gone for like 3 days, man. I don't know what's happened. So the dad's like, we got to go to San Francisco, go see if we can find her. So they get the cops involved. They're interviewing people at the coffee shop. And allegedly around 3:45 p.m., the day that she disappeared, she was spotted by a coworker who saw her like warmly chit-chatting with a blonde woman. And nobody knows who this blonde woman is. She was last seen on surveillance videos withdrawing cash from an ATM. And the thing is that her classes were scheduled to start the next day, and she had already paid for those classes.
So it's not like she's like, well, I'm going to go to Arizona with my, you know, with this girl I met. It's you can rule out the I'm going to just be a crazy kid and move on. You've paid for these classes, which Berkeley, I'm sure it's a fortune.
And it was like a summer bloodhound. School photography class, but yeah, they do bring a bloodhound in. Sorry.
Yeah. And the reenactment of the bloodhound, I always like to see dogs and everything, but the more I read about them, the more inaccurate I've found that they can be. But the dog does track her to, Land's End Beach. Her scent is tracked to, but that's over 6 miles away.
Yeah, and they said, like, we don't even know. Maybe she went there a different day. Like, we don't even know that's the place where she last went. But apparently she had told her roommates that she was going to be attending a party there. And they're like, did she get swept away? Because this isn't, like, your typical California beach. This one's the ones with, like, the big jagged rocks in there. And they said, like, a lot of tourists come out here and get swept away. Like, it happens numerous times a year and people die. So they're like, is that the case? But then they instantly go, oh, that's probably not the case because it's such a touristy area that people would have noticed a girl getting swept out into the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody accidentally falls, the first thing you do is call for help. You don't cover it up.
Right. Yeah, 100%. But, you know, here's where it gets really crazy. So on July 10th, a man anonymously calls a San Francisco news station, and he's like, I know who killed Kristen, okay? She's dead because of a lesbian love triangle gone awry. And he even names the two women, and he says that her body was dumped from a wooden bridge near Point Reyes, which is like, let's take a look in that area because that sounds a little too specific to be made up.
Now, do you call a news station instead of the police because it just gets more immediate attention?
Maybe you do it because they're less likely to be able to trace your call.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe it's less legal. Like, I mean, the legality surrounding it. But I still would imagine that the guy who does it would be smart enough to at least do it from a payphone or something.
This guy's such a freaking
idiot. Yeah, he's a dope.
They investigate the women, and they conclude the women had absolutely nothing to do with it. So they're like, who would want to set you up like this? Like, who would want to make you go to prison for murder? And they're like, there's only one person, and that guy's name is John, okay? They don't give his last name on Unsolved Mysteries, but he has been all over the place. He's been on America's Most Wanted. He's been on a ton of stuff. So I'm just going to say his name is John Onuma.
And we know what you look like, John, because you are not consistent with letting people see your face.
Exactly. So on Unsolved Mysteries, he's like all silhouetted and he's got that like deep voice where they change his voice and stuff. But we totally have a picture of him. And John says that the two women were his girlfriend, we'll just call her Jill. They were Jill's bosses and that they were harassing her. So, you know, when your boss harasses you, you try and set them up for murder. So they looked into John's background, and they found that he has a record of abusing women. One of the women on America's Most Wanted called him a human vampire.
Wow.
Everyone said that he would meet women through personal ads and then try to sexually assault them once they got there. And at the very least, he would always end up like stealing their cash that they had on them. So he's a scumbag. And cops had previously found a personal ad in Kristen's apartment. She lived in Oakland, and they think that she placed this ad, but I think it's probably more likely that she responded to this ad because it was circled and it was in the garbage. So,
yeah, I don't think you circle your own ad unless you're Steve Martin from The Jerk.
And you're like, oh my God. But
yeah, I'm in there.
The article says, and I quote, friends, female seeking friends to share activities who enjoy music, photography, working out, walks, coffee, or simply the beach, exploring the Bay Area. Interested? Call me.
My question here is, what number was that? Like, whose number? Was it says interested, call me, but...
Great question.
You know, they don't... I'm just kind of curious who that was.
I can't believe that thought never even entered my mind. That's a great question.
But I was still assuming that it was hers, and that's why they were saying that they thought it was her who posted it, but it was kind of strange, but I don't know if we have the answer to that.
I don't know, but here's what I do know that they don't talk about on Unsolved Mysteries at all. Okay, Kristen, our little sweet little innocent dimpled Kristen, was the only woman in a house with four male roommates who never reported her missing. She met them off of Craigslist in 1997.
That was a surprise to you that it even existed.
I was shocked that it existed back then, but apparently it was like a Bay Area specific thing in 1995 is when it was invented. But when I heard Craigslist, I was like, whoa, this is more modern than I thought. So we learn that John kind of uses women to lure women back to him, which is very, very common with sex traffickers. They will like send a woman, oh, hey, girl, what's going on? And you feel more comfortable.
What is this schmuck doing to get the women to lure the women to him? Figure out. I mean, is he giving them money, drugs, protection of some sort?
He's an abusive SOB. I'm guessing that he's like sending his girlfriend out there and it's like, I won't hit you tonight if you go get your quota of innocent, wide-eyed, you know, North Carolina women. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he just wants to be a thug so bad. So police interview another woman who he had abused. And she says that John told her, quote, now you know what I did to Kristen. Don't make me do it to you.
Allegedly.
Well, that's what
she
said.
No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. Of course he said that. I think that this guy is so deeply involved with this particular situation that, it's horrifying. And we'd never really get, I mean, he says that the I'm looking at the wrong thing. I'm sorry. They search his house. They search John's girlfriend's house, and they realize that there's a lot of manipulation of evidence that could have existed. Like, her diary is missing several pages. Who keeps a diary? And it just so happens to be the same period that Kristen was in San Francisco. So this could have been this, like, sordid love affair or manipulation or...
And supposedly the girlfriend, Jill, she says that John tore the pages out because he didn't want it to come back to bite him.
And it didn't. It worked somehow.
I guess.
That's why they didn't do the old pencil trick where you trace it over the other pages.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure they have those type of techniques that are much better than a pencil. But the whole thing is so shady and... he takes a polygraph. He passes.
Supposedly. That's what he says. We have no proof of that.
Oh, he's the only person to vet that information?
Yeah.
And even if he did pass, I don't buy, I don't give polygraphs really much credence one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
He also claims to have never met or seen Kristen. How do you know? You seem very sure. Cadaver dogs searched Kristen's apartment and found evidence of human decomposition between her apartment next door.
Yeah, this is like our fancy Unsolved Mysteries Rewind update because that's where we left Unsolved Mysteries. So in 2015, those cadaver dogs are brought in to search the apartment that she shared with those four male roommates. And again, I'm saying, let's take a look at those guys. an investigator has this like invention that tests for the gases that are released through your body through decomposition, and found no evidence of a body, but that decomposition was there and it was from the crime, probably.
Sounds like magic. I don't know. I'm not saying these things couldn't exist. I mean, we have touch DNA testing that happens nowadays where you could just touch a piece of paper and it can pull DNA off of it. But I don't know. It doesn't really help either. It just shows that there was some decomposition of her DNA there.
And how many times do we find that where it's like, there's no body here, but there probably was a dead body here at one point. It's like, what? It's at least the third time that that's happened on our show. But there's a concrete slab in the basement. So they find it's between her house and next door to her house. And there's a concrete slab that is supposedly like poorly constructed there. But they'd have to, there's a hard clay underneath. So they still think it's unlikely that she's buried there. But they do DNA testing on the decomposition and that was hit on. And the testing matches to Bob and Debbie, her parents' DNA. So it's likely that this is from Kristen. Mm. They think that Kristen was killed in the basement. So they have to turn everything over to the cops. And the cops just have, this has not risen to the top of their radar yet. So this all, the DNA and everything, that's all private investigators. And their hands are tied. And the cops, I'm sure, have bigger issues than a 23-year-old cold case. But we do get Kristen's Act, which was signed into law by Bill Clinton in 2000, which adds funding for missing adults because Kristen was 18 when she disappeared. But apparently acts expire because it expired in 2005 and funding has since been slashed.
It's kind of weird. You know, 5 years. It seems like a lot of work to just let it expire 5 years later.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a guy who's like a family friend named Dennis Mahone. He's super obsessed with the case. He's been trying to locate her since it happened. He has a podcast on her disappearance. And there's also an episode of the TV show Disappeared about Kristen and her disappearance.
Now, there was another. Does he run the findkristen.com website?
Do you know? I don't know.
Because that says Kristen's podcast. And I found it like last minute. So I didn't know if that was the same thing. But you know, it seems as though everybody is really trying to get justice through the independent media use of podcasting. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, she's so like wholesome faced and I just, oh, poor little thing.
And that's it. Yeah, that's where it ends. Him. There's no more. Yeah. I have no doubt in my mind. Now, nothing's ever come out about John, right? Like, I mean, there's no evidence to link him.
No, but I'm sorry. I just looked it up. It is his podcast. It is Dennis Mahone's podcast. But nope, nothing has come out about John. And while I think John is most definitely a scummy sleazebag, I still want to look into those roommates. Their name has never been released. The private investigators have talked to the police and said they need to be re-interviewed. That hasn't happened. Like, let's just look into this because it looks like she was probably killed at her home.
Yeah,
and if she had been there for 3 weeks, so they only knew this girl for 3 weeks. Four guys, you know, you can get real like mob mentality, testosterone-y kind of thing. I don't know. I don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, at the very least, it should be an option to, you know, to at least look at these people and see if they have a history. It's possible they did look into these people and they all completely are, you know, you have one who's like becoming a cop and he's a clean record. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just saying that it's possible that they did look into them. I would think it would be a no-brainer to look into the four guys who she lived with.
Yeah, that's true.
But you never know. I mean, it's also one of them could have been the police chief's son. And they're like, no.
Exactly.
Leave them alone.
Or maybe somebody had a kid and then they're like, oh, is this what human life is about? Like, oh, maybe. And then they start feeling worse after 23 years and more willing to talk about it. I don't know. But
yeah,
I wish they would talk to them again. But like you said, maybe they have. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, 20 years has passed. More than 20 years has passed. So, and their names are never released, huh?
Mm-mm.
Well, it's very, very strange that they wouldn't have even come out and said, yeah, I lived with, you know, like post somewhere. Like, yeah, she was my roommate.
Yeah. Sad stuff. Poor girl.
Yeah. But, Kim, thank you so much for getting together for this episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. I do appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. If you guys want to see episode resources, please follow us, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, that would be very helpful to us.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.